4. When Locke managed to elbow his way back down to the second floor at last, the young man in the cage was limping, bleeding and wobbling on his feet. Half a dozen stiletto wasps were free in the enclosure, hovering and darting around him. Locke sighed as he pushed through the crowd.
"Master Costa, returned to us just in time for the issue to be settled, I believe."
Madame Duresne smiled over the top of her drink, some milky orange liquor in a slender glass vessel nearly a foot high. Jean was sipping from a smaller tumbler of something pale brown, and he passed an identical glass to Locke, who took it up with a grateful nod. Honeyed rum, hard enough to avoid Duresne's scorn, but not quite powerful enough to start beating anyone's better judgment down for the evening. "Is it about that time? My apologies for my absence. Silly little business."
"Silly? With one of the priori involved?"
"I made the mistake of showing him a card trick last week," said Locke. "Now he's making arrangements for me to perform the same trick for, a friend of his."
"It must be an impressive trick, then. More impressive than what you usually do at a card table."
"I doubt it, madam." Locke took a long sip from his drink. "For one thing, I don't have to worry about such excellent opposition when I'm performing a card trick."
"Has anyone ever tried to cut out that disgustingly silver tongue of yours, Master Costa?"
"It's become a traditional pastime in several cities I could mention." In the cage, the mad buzzing of the wasps grew louder as more of them exploded from their cells. 2, 3, 4. Locke shuddered and watched helplessly as the blurry dark shapes hurtled around the meshed cage. The young man tried to stand his ground, then panicked and began to flail wildly. One wasp met his glove and was slapped to the floor, but another alighted on his lower back and drove its body down. The boy howled, slapped at it, and arched his back. The crowd grew deadly silent in mingled horror and anticipation. It was fast, but Locke would never have called it merciful. The wasps swarmed the young man, darting and stinging, digging their clawed legs into his blood-soaked shirt. One on his chest, one on his arm, its abdomen pulsing madly up and down. One fluttered about his hair, and another drove its sting home into the nape of his neck. The boy's wild screams became wet choking noises. Foam trickled from his mouth, blood ran in rivulets down his face and chest, and at last he fell over, twitching wildly. The wasps buzzed and stalked atop his body, looking horribly like blood-coloured ants as they went about their business, still stinging and biting. Locke's stomach revolted against the small breakfast he'd eaten at the Villa Candessa, and he bit down hard on one of his curled fingers, using the pain to assert some self-control. When he turned back to Madame Duresne, his face was once again placid.
"Well," she said, waving the 4 wooden sticks at him and Jean, "this is a tolerable salve for the wounds I still bear from our last meeting. But when shall we have the pleasure of full redress?"
"It can't possibly come soon enough," said Locke. "But if you'll excuse us for the evening, we've got some political difficulties to discuss. And before we leave, I'm going to dispose of my drink on the body of the man who's cost us 200 solari." Madame Duresne waved airily and was reloading her silver pipe from a leather pouch before Locke and Jean had taken 2 steps. Locke's queasiness rose again as he approached the cage. The crowd was breaking up around him, trading marker sticks and enthusiastic babble. The last few paces around the cage, though, were already clear. The noise and movement in the room around them was keeping the wasps agitated. As Locke approached the cage, a pair leapt back into the air and hovered menacingly, beating loudly against the inner layer of mesh and following him along. Their black eyes seemed to stare right into his. He cringed despite himself. He knelt as close to the young man's body as he could get, and in seconds half the free wasps in the enclosure were buzzing and batting against the mesh just a foot or two from his face. Locke threw the remaining half of his rum on the wasp-covered corpse. Behind him there was an eruption of laughter.
"That's the spirit, friend!
came a slurred voice. "Clumsy son of a bitch, cost me 500 solari. Take a piss on him while you're down there."
"Crooked warden," Locke muttered under his breath, speaking quickly. "A glass poured on the ground for a stranger without friends. Lord of gallants and fools, ease this man's passage to the lady of the long silence. This was a hell of a way to die. Do this for me and I'll try not to ask for anything for a while. I really do mean that this time." Locke kissed the back of his left hand and stood up. With the blessing said, suddenly it seemed that he couldn't be far enough away from the cage.
"Where now?" asked Jean quietly.
"The hell away from these god's damned bugs."
5. The sky was clear over the sea and roofed in by clouds to the east. A high pearlescent ceiling hung there like frozen smoke beneath the moons. A hard breeze was blowing past them as they trudged across the docks that fringed the inner side of the great gallery, whipping discarded papers and other bits of junk about their feet. A ship's bell echoed across the lapping silver water. On their left, a dark elderglass wall rose story after story like a looming cliff, crossed here and there by rickety stairs with faint lanterns to guide the way of those stumbling up and down them. At the top of those heights was the night market, and the edge of the vast roof that covered the tiers of the island down to the waves on its other side.
"Oh, fantastic!" said Jean, when Locke had finished his recounting of what had transpired in Requin's office. "So now we've got Requin thinking that Stragos is out to get him. I've never helped precipitate a civil war before. This should be fun."
"I didn't have much choice," said Locke. "Can you think of any other convincing reasons for Stragos to take a personal interest in us? Without a good explanation, I was going out that window. That much was clear."
"If only you'd landed on your head, you'd have nothing to fear but the bill for damaged cobblestones. Do you think Stragos needs to know that Requin's not as blind to his agents as he thought?"
"Oh, fuck the son of a bitch."
"Didn't think so.
Besides, for all we know, Stragos really is out to get Requin. They're certainly not friends, and trouble's brewing all over this damned city. On the asset side of the ledger," said Locke, "I think Selendrig can be sweet-talked, at least a little bit, and it seems that Requin really thinks of me as his."
"Well, good on that. Do you think it's time to give him the chairs?"
"Yeah, the chairs. The chairs. Yes, let's do it before Stragos decides to push us around some more."
"I'll have them taken out of storage and brought round in a cart whenever you like."
"Good. I'll deliver them later this week, then. You mind avoiding the Sin Spire for a night or two?"
"Of course not. Any particular reason?"
"I just want to disappoint Durenna and Corvalur for a bit. Until we're a little more secure with our situation, I'd really prefer not to waste another night losing money and getting drunk. The Bella Paranella trick might rouse suspicion if we pull it again."
"If you put it that way, I can't say no. How about if I poke around in a few other places and see if I can catch any whispers about the Archon and the Priori? I think we might arm ourselves with a little more of this city's history."
"Lovely. What the hell's this?"
They were not alone on the dockside. In addition to occasional strangers hurrying here and there on business, there were boatmen sleeping under cloaks beside their tied-up craft, and a fair number of drunks and derelicts curled up beneath any shelter they could claim. A pile of crates lay just a few paces to their left, and in its shadow sat a thin figure covered in layers of torn rags near a tiny alchemical globe that shone a pale red. The figure clutched a small burlap sack and beckoned to them with one pale hand.
"Sirs! Sirs!"
The loud croaking voice seemed to be a woman's.
"For pity's sake, you fine gentlemen! For pity's sake! For Perelandro's sake! A coin! Any coin, thin copper would do. Have pity for Perelandro's sake."
Locke's hand went to his purse, just inside his frock coat. Jean had taken his coat off and now carried it folded over his right arm. He seemed content to let Locke see to the evening's act of charity.
"For Perelandro's sake, madam, you may have more than just a centira."
Temporarily distracted by the warm glow of his own affected gallantry, Locke was holding out 3 silver volani before the first little warning managed to register. The beggar would be happy to have 1 thin copper, and had a loud voice. Why hadn't they heard her speaking to any of the strangers who'd passed by just ahead of them? And why was she reaching out with the burlap sack rather than an open hand? Jean was faster than he was, and with no more elegant way to get Locke to safety, he raised his left arm and gave Locke a hard shove. A crossbow bolt punched a neat dark hole in the burlap sack and hissed through the air between them. Locke felt it tug at his coattails as he fell sideways. He toppled over a smaller crate and landed clumsily on his back. He sat up just in time to see Jean kick the beggar in the face. The woman's head snapped back, but she planted her hands on the ground and scissored her legs, sweeping Jean off his feet. As Jean hit the ground and tossed his folded coat away, the beggar drew her legs straight up, kicked them down, and seemed to fling herself forward in an arc. She was on her feet in a second, casting off her rags. "Ah, shit, she's a foot boxer, a bloody chassonneur," Locke thought, stumbling to his feet. "Jean hates that." Locke twitched his coat sleeves and a stiletto fell into each hand. Moving warily, he skipped across the stones toward Jean's attacker, who was kicking Jean in the ribs as the big man attempted to roll away. Locke was within 3 paces of the chassonneur when the slap of boot leather against the ground warned of a presence close behind him. He raised the stiletto in his right hand as though to strike Jean's assailant, then ducked and whirled, lunging blindly to his rear with the left-hand blade. Locke was instantly glad he'd ducked. Something whirled past his head close enough to tear painfully at his hair. His new attacker was another beggar, a man close to his own stature, and he'd just missed a swing with a long iron chain that would have opened Locke's skull like an egg. The force of the man's attack helped carry him onto the point of Locke's stiletto, which plunged in up to the hilt just beneath the man's right armpit. The man gasped, and Locke pressed his advantage ruthlessly, bringing his other blade down overhand and burying it in the man's left clavicle. Locke wrenched both of his blades as savagely as he could, and the man moaned. The chain slipped from his fingers and hit the stones with a clatter. A second later, Locke worked his blades out of the man's body as though he were pulling skewers from meat and let the poor fellow slump to the ground. He raised his bloody stilettos, turned, and with a sudden burst of ill-advised self-confidence, charged Jean's assailant. She kicked out from the hip, barely sparing him a glance. Her foot struck his sternum. It felt like walking into a brick wall. He stumbled back, and she took the opportunity to step away from Jean, who looked to have been rather pummeled, and advance on Locke. Her rags were discarded. Locke saw that she was a young woman, probably younger than he was, wearing loose dark clothing and a thin, well-fashioned ribbed leather vest. She was Therin, relatively dark-skinned, with tightly braided black hair that circled her head like a crown. She had a poise that said she'd killed before. "No problem," thought Locke as he moved backward. "So have I." That's when he tripped over the body of the man he'd just stabbed. She took an instant advantage of his misstep. Just as he regained his balance, she snapped out in an arc with her right leg. Her foot landed like a hammer against Locke's left forearm, and he swore as his stiletto flew from suddenly nerveless fingers. Incensed, he lunged with his right-hand blade. Moving as deftly as Jean ever had, she grabbed his right wrist with her left hand, pulled him irresistibly forward, and slammed the heel of her right hand into his chin. His remaining stiletto whirled into the darkness like a man diving from a tall building, and suddenly the dark sky above him was replaced with looming grey stones. He made their acquaintance hard enough to rattle his teeth like dice in a cup. She kicked him once to roll him over onto his back, then planted a foot on his chest to pin him down.
She'd caught one of his blades, and he watched in a daze as she bent forward to put it to use. His hands were numb, traitorously slow, and he felt an unbearable itching sensation on his unprotected neck as his own stiletto dipped toward it. Locke didn't hear Jean's hatchet sink into her back, but he saw its effect and guessed the cause. The woman jerked upright, arched backward, and let the stiletto slip. It clattered against the ground just beside Locke's face, and he flinched. His assailant sank down to her knees just beside him, breathing in swift, shallow gasps, and then twisted away. He could see one of Jean's wicked sisters buried in a spreading dark stain on her lower back, just to the right of her spine. Jean stepped over Locke, reached down and yanked the hatchet from the woman's back. She gasped, fell forward, and was viciously yanked back upright by Jean, who stood behind her and placed the blade of his hatchet against her throat. Leo Canto, are you all right? With this much pain, Locke gasped, I know I can't be dead. Good enough. Jean applied more force to the hatchet, which he was holding just behind its head, like a barber wielding a beard scraper. Start talking. I can help you die without further pain, or I can even help you live. You're no simple bandit. Who put you here?
My back, sobbed the woman, her voice trembling and utterly without threat. Please, please, it hurts.
It's supposed to. Who put you here? Who hired you?
Gold, said Locke, coughing. White iron. We can pay you. Double. Just give us a name. Oh, gods, it hurts.
Jean seized her by the hair with his free hand and pulled. She cried out and straightened up. Locke blinked as he saw what appeared to be a dark feathered shape burst out of her chest. The wet thud of the crossbow quarrel's impact didn't register until a split second later. Jean leapt back, dumbfounded, and dropped the woman to the ground. A moment later, he looked past Locke and gestured threateningly with his hatchet. You!
At your service, Master de Ferrer.
Locke craned his head back far enough to catch an upside-down glimpse of the woman who'd stolen them off the street and delivered them to the Archon a few nights before. Her dark hair fluttered freely behind her in the breeze. She wore a tight black jacket over a grey waistcoat and a grey skirt, and held a discharged crossbow in her left hand. She was walking toward them at a leisurely pace from the direction they'd come. Locke groaned and rolled over until she was right side up. Beside him, the beggar chasseneur gave one last wet cough and died.
"Gods damn it!" cried Jean. "I was about to get some answers from her!" "No, you weren't," said the Archon's agent. "Take a look at her right hand."
Locke, climbing shakily to his feet, and Jean both did so. A slender knife with a curved blade glistened there by the faint light of the moons and the few dockside lamps.
"I was assigned to watch over you two," the woman said as she stepped up beside Locke, beaming contentedly.
"Fine fucking job," said Jean, rubbing his ribs with his left hand.
"You seem to be doing well enough until the end."
She looked down at the little knife and nodded.
"Look. This knife has an extra groove right alongside the cutting edge. That usually means something nasty on the blade. She was buying time to slip it out and stick you with it."
"I know what a groove along the blade means," mumbled Jean petulantly. "Do you know who the hell these two work for?"
"I have some theories, yes."
"And would you mind sharing them?" asked Locke.
"If I were given orders to that effect," she said sweetly.
"God's damn all Ferrari and give them more sores on their privates than hairs on their heads," muttered Locke.
"I was born in Vel Verazzo," said the woman.
"Do you have a name?" asked Jean.
"Lots, all of them lovely and none of them true," she replied. "You two can call me Meraine."
"Meraine. Ow!"
Locke winced and massaged his left forearm with his right hand. Jean set a hand on his shoulder.
"Anything broken, Leo?"
"Not much.
Perhaps my dignity and my previous presumptions of divine benevolence. Locke sighed. We've seen people following us for the past few nights, Meraine. I suppose we must have seen you.
I doubt it. You gentlemen should collect your things and start walking. Same direction you were moving before. There'll be constables here soon enough, and the constables don't take orders from my employer.
Locke retrieved his wet stilettos and wiped them on the trousers of the man he'd killed before returning them to his sleeves. Now that the anger of the fight had run cold, Locke felt his gorge rising at the sight of the corpse, and he scuttled away as fast as he could. Jean gathered up his coat and slipped his hatchet into it. Soon enough the three of them were walking along, Meraine in the middle with her elbows linked in theirs.
"My employer," she said after a few moments, "wished me to watch over you tonight, and when convenient show you down to a boat."
"Wonderful," said Locke. "Another private conversation."
"I can't say, but if I were to conjecture, I'd guess that he's found a job for the pair of you."
Jean spared a quick glance for the two bodies lying in the darkness far behind them, and he coughed into his clenched fist. "Splendid," he growled. "This place has been so dull and uncomplicated so far." Reminiscence. The Amusement War. 1. 6 days north up the coast road from Talvera, the demi-city of Salon-Corbeau lies within an unusually verdant cleft in the black seaside rocks. More than a private estate, not quite a functional village, the demi-city clings to its peculiar life in the smouldering shadow of Mount Azar. In the time of the Therin throne, Azar exploded to life, burying 3 living villages and 10,000 souls in a matter of minutes. These days it seems content merely to rumble and brood, sending twisting charcoal plumes out to sea, and flights of ravens wheel without concern beneath the tired old volcano's smoke. Here begin the hot, dusty plains called the Adra Morcala, inhabited by few and loved by none. They roll like a cracked dry sea all the way to the southern boundaries of Balinel, most westerly and desolate canton of the Kingdom of the Seven Marrows. Locke Lamora rode into Salon-Corbeau on the 9th day of Aurim, in the 78th year of Nara. A mild westerly winter, a fruitful year, and more, had passed since he and Jean had first set foot in Talvera, and in the armoured strongbox at the rear of Locke's rented carriage rattled 1,000 gold solari, stolen at billiards from a certain Lord Landrival of Espara, who was unusually sensitive to lemons. The little harbour that served the demi-city was thick with small craft, yachts and pleasure barges and coasting galleys with square silk sails. Farther out, upon the open sea, a galleon and a sloop rode at anchor, each flying the pennant of Lashane under family crests and colours Locke didn't recognise. The breeze was slight and the sun was pale, more silver than gold behind the hazy exhalations of the mountain.
"Welcome to Salon-Corbeau," said a footman in livery of black and olive green, with a tall hat of pressed black felt. "How are you styled, and how must you be announced?"
A liveried woman placed a wooden block beneath the open door to Locke's carriage, and he stepped out, bracing his hands in the small of his back and stretching with relief before hopping to the ground. He wore a drooping black moustache beneath black-rimmed optics and slick black hair. His heavy black coat was tight in the chest and shoulders, but flared out from waist to knees, fluttering behind him like a cape. He had eschewed the more refined hose and shoes for grey pantaloons tucked into knee-high field boots, dull black beneath a faint layer of road dust.
"I am Mordevai Fairwhite, a merchant of Emberlane," he said. "I doubt that I shall require announcement, as I have no title of any consequence."
"Very good, Master Fairwhite," said the footman smoothly. "The Lady Saljeska appreciates your visit to Salon-Corbeau and earnestly wishes you good fortune in your affairs."
"Appreciates your visit," noted Locke,
rather than would be most pleased to receive your audience. Countess Vera Salgeska of Lachaine was the absolute ruler of Salon Corbeau. The demi-city was built on one of her estates, equally distant from Balinel, Talvarat, and Lachaine, just out of convenient rulership by any of them. Salon Corbeau was more or less an autonomous resort state for the wealthy of the Brass Coast. In addition to the constant arrival of carriages along the coast roads and pleasure vessels from the sea, Salon Corbeau attracted one other noteworthy form of traffic, which Locke had meditated on in a melancholy fashion during his journey. Ragged groups of peasants, urban poor and rural wretches alike, trudged wearily along the dusty roads to Lady Salgeska's domain. They came in intermittent but ceaseless streams, flowing to the strange private city beneath the dark heights of the mountain. Locke imagined that he already knew exactly what they were coming for, but his next few days in Salon Corbeau would prove that understanding to be woefully incomplete. 2. Locke had originally expected that a sea voyage to Lachaine or even Isara might be necessary to secure the final pieces of his Sinspire scheme, but conversation with several wealthier Verari had convinced him that Salon Corbeau might have exactly what he needed. Picture a seaside valley carved from night-dark stone, perhaps 300 yards in length and 100 wide. Its little harbour lies on its western side, with a crescent beach of fine black sand. At its eastern end, an underground stream pours out of a fissure in the rocks, rushing down a stepped arrangement of stones. The headlands above this stream are commanded by Countess Salgeska's residence, a stone manor house above two layers of crenellated walls, a minor fortress. The valley walls of Salon Corbeau are perhaps 20 yards in height, and for nearly their full length they are terraced with gardens. Thick ferns, twisting vines, blossoming orchids, and fruit and olive trees flourish there, a healthy curtain of brown and green in vivid relief against the black, with little water ducts meandering throughout to keep Salgeska's artificial paradise from growing thirsty. In the very centre of the valley is a circular stadium, and the gardens on both sides of this stone structure share the walls with several dozen sturdy buildings of polished stone and lacquered wood. A miniature city rests on stilts and platforms and terraces, charmingly enclosed by walkways and stairs at every level. Locke strolled these walkways on the afternoon of his arrival, looking for his ultimate goal with a stately lack of haste. He expected to be here for many days, perhaps even weeks. Salon Corbeau, like the chance houses of Talvarat, drew the idle rich in large numbers. Locke walked among Verari merchants and Lashani nobles, among scions of the Western Marrows, past Nessi ladies-in-waiting, or perhaps more accurately, ladies-weighted down, in more cloth of gold than Locke would have previously thought possible, and the landed families they served. Here and there he was sure he even spotted Camori, olive-skinned and haughty, though thankfully none were important enough for him to recognize. So many bodyguards and so many bodies to guard, rich bodies and faces, people who could afford proper alchemy and physic for their ailments. No weeping sores or sagging facial tumors, no crooked teeth lolling out of bleeding gums, no faces pinched by emaciation. The Sinspire crowd might be more exclusive, but these folk were even more refined, even more pampered. Hired musicians followed some of them, so that even little journeys of 30 or 40 yards need not threaten a second of boredom. Rich men and women were hemorrhaging money all around Locke to the strains of music. Even a man like Mordavi Fairwhite might spend less to eat for a month than some of them would throw away just to be noticed at breakfast each day. He'd come to Salon Corbeau because of these folk, not to rob them for once, but to make use of their privileged existence. Where the rich nested like bright-feathered birds, the providers of the luxuries and services they relied upon followed.
Salon Corbeau had a permanent community of tailors, clothiers, instrument makers, glass benders, alchemists, caterers, entertainers, and carpenters. A small community, to be sure, but one of the highest reputation, fit for aristocratic patronage and priced accordingly. Almost in the middle of Salon Corbeau's south gallery, Locke found the shop he had come all this way to visit, a rather long, two-story stone building without windows along its walkway face. The wooden sign above the single door said, "Monsieur Beaumondaine and Daughters, Household Devices and Fine Furniture by Appointment." On the door of the Beaumondaine shop was a scrollwork decoration, the crest of the Salgeska family, as Locke had glimpsed on banners fluttering here and there and on the crossbelts of Salon Corbeau's guards, implying Lady Vera's personal approval of the work that went on there, meaningless to Locke, since he knew too little of Salgeska's taste to judge it. But the Beaumondaine reputation stretched all the way to Tal Verar. He would send a messenger first thing in the morning, as was appropriate, and request an appointment to discuss the matter of some peculiar chairs he needed built. 3. At the second hour of the next afternoon, a warm, soft rain was falling, a weak and wispy thing that hung in the air more like damp gauze than falling water. Vague columns of mist swirled among the plants and atop the valley, and the walkways were for once clear of most of their well-heeled traffic. Grey clouds necklaced the tall black mountain to the northwest. Locke stood outside the door to the Beaumondaine shop with water dripping down the back of his neck and rapped sharply 3 times. The door swung inward immediately. A wiry man of about 50 peered out at Locke through round optics. He wore a simple cotton tunic cinched up above his elbows, revealing guild tattoos in faded green and black on his lean forearms, and a long leather apron with at least 6 visible pockets on the front. Most of them held tools. One held a grey kitten, with only its little head visible.
"Master Fairwhite, Mordavi Fairwhite?"
"So pleased you could make the time for me," began Locke. He spoke with a faint Vajran accent, just enough to suggest an origin in the far north. He'd decided to be lazy and let this Fairwhite be as fluent in Therin as possible. Locke stretched out his right hand to shake. In his left he carried a black leather satchel with an iron lock upon its flap.
"Master Beaumondaine, I presume?"
"None other. Come in directly, sir, out of the rain. Will you take coffee? Allow me to trade you a cup for your coat."
"With pleasure."
The foyer of the Beaumondaine shop was a high, cosily panelled room lit with little golden lanterns in wall sconces. A counter with one swinging door ran across the rear of the room, and behind it Locke could see shelves piled high with samples of wood, cloth, wax, and oils in glass jars. The place smelled of sanded wood, a sharp and pleasant tang. There was a little sitting area before the counter where 2 superbly wrought chairs with black velvet cushions stood upon a floor tapestry. Locke set his satchel at his feet, turned to allow Beaumondaine to help him shrug out of his damp black coat, picked up his satchel once again, and settled himself in the chair nearest to the door. The carpenter hung Locke's coat on a brass hook on the wall.
"Just a moment, if you please," he said, and went behind the counter.
From his new vantage point, Locke could see that a canvas-covered door led from behind the counter to what he presumed must be the workshop. Beaumondaine pushed the canvas flap aside and yelled,
"Loris, the coffee!"
Some muffled reply that he evidently found satisfactory came back to him from the workshop, and he hurried around the counter to take his place in the chair across from Locke, crinkling his seamy face into a welcoming smile. A few moments later, the canvas flew aside once again, and out from the workshop came a freckled girl of 15 or 16 years, chestnut-haired, slim in the manner of her father, but more firmly muscled about the arms and shoulders.
She carried a wooden tray before her, set with cups and silver pots, and when she stepped through the door in the counter, Locke saw the tray had legs like a very short table. She placed the coffee service between Locke and her father, just to the side, and gave Locke a respectful nod.
"My oldest daughter, Loris," said Master Beaumondaine. "Loris, this is Master Fairwhite of the House of Bel Sarathon from Emberlane."
"Charmed," said Locke. Loris was close enough for him to see that her hair was full of curly little wood shavings.
"Your servant, Master Fairwhite."
Loris nodded again, prepared to withdraw, and then caught sight of the grey kitten sticking out of her father's apron pocket.
"Father, you've forgotten Lively. Surely you didn't mean to have him sit in on the coffee?" "Have I? Oh dear, I see that I have."
Beaumondaine reached down and eased the kitten out of his apron. Locke was astonished to see how limply it hung in his hands, with its legs and tail drooping and its little head lolling. What self-respecting cat would sleep while plucked up and carried through the air? Then Locke saw the answer, as Loris took Lively in her own hands and turned to go. The kitten's little eyes were wide open and stark white.
"That creature was gentled," said Locke in a low voice when Loris had returned to the workshop.
"I'm afraid so," said the carpenter.
"I've never seen such a thing. What purpose does it serve in a cat?"
"None, Master Fairwhite, none."
Beaumondaine's smile was gone, replaced by a wary and uncomfortable expression.
"And it certainly wasn't my doing. My youngest daughter, Parnella, found him abandoned behind the Villa Verdante."
Beaumondaine referred to the huge luxury inn where the intermediate class of Salon Corbeau's visitors stayed, the wealthy who were not private guests of the Lady Salgesca. Locke himself was rooming there.
"Damned strange."
"We call him Lively as a sort of jest, though he does little. He must be coaxed to eat and prodded to excrete, you see. Parnella thought it would be kinder to smash his skull, but Loris would not hear of it, and so I could not refuse. You must think me weak and doting."
"Not at all," said Locke, shaking his head. "The world is cruel enough without our compounding it. I approve. I meant that it was damned strange that anyone should do such a thing at all."
"Master Fairwhite," the carpenter licked his lips nervously, "you seem a humane man, and you must understand, our position here brings us a steady and lucrative business. My daughters will have quite an inheritance when I turn this shop over to them. There are things about Salon Corbeau, things that go on, that we artisans do not pry into. Must not, if you take my meaning."
"I do," said Locke, eager to keep the man in a good humour. However, he made a mental note to perhaps poke around in pursuit of whatever was disturbing the carpenter.
"I do indeed. So let us speak no more of the matter, and instead look to business."
"Most kind," said Beaumondaine, with obvious relief. "How do you take your coffee? I have honey and cream."
"Honey, please."
Beaumondaine poured steaming coffee from the silver pot into a thick glass cup and spooned in honey until Locke nodded. Locke sipped at his cup while Beaumondaine bombarded his own with enough cream to turn it leather brown. It was quality brew, rich and very hot.
"My compliments," Locke mumbled over a slightly scalded tongue.
"It's from Isara. Lady Salgesca's household has an endless thirst for the stuff," said the carpenter. "The rest of us buy pecks and pinches from her cellars when they come around. Now, your messenger said that you wished to discuss a commission that was, in her words, very particular."
"Yes, indeed," said Locke. "Particular to a design and an end that may strike you as eccentric. I assure you, I am in grave earnest."
Locke set down his coffee and lifted his satchel into his lap.
then pulled a small key from his waistcoat pocket to open the lock. He reached inside and drew out a few pieces of folded parchment.
"You must be familiar," Locke continued, "with the style of the last few years of the Therin throne. The very last few, just before Talathri died in battle against the Bonds Magi."
He passed over one of his sheets of parchment, which Beaumondaine removed his optics to examine.
"Oh, yes," the carpenter said slowly. "The Talathri Baroque, also called the Last Flowering. Yes, I've done pieces in this fashion before. Loris has as well. You have an interest in this style?"
"I require a suite of chairs," said Locke. "Four of them. Leather-backed, lacquered sheer crescent with real gold insets."
"Sheer crescent is a somewhat delicate wood, fit only for occasional use. For more regular sitting, I'm sure you'd want witchwood."
"My master," said Locke, "has very exact tastes, however peculiar. He insisted upon sheer crescent several times to ensure that his wishes were clear."
"Well, if you wished them carved from marzipan, I suppose I should have to do it. With the clear understanding, of course, that I did warn you against hard use."
"Naturally. I assure you, Master Beaumondaine, you won't be held liable for anything that happens to these chairs after they leave your workshop."
"Oh, I would never do less than vouch for our work, but I cannot make a soft wood hard, Master Fairwhite. Well, then, I do have some books with excellent illustrations of this style. Your artist has done well to start with, but I'd like to give you more variety to choose from."
"By all means," said Locke, and he sipped his coffee contentedly as the carpenter rose and returned to the workshop door.
"Loris," Beaumondaine cried, "my three volumes of Vellonetta. Yes, those.